We cannot walk those streets again, nor summon back the look or sounds of that summer afternoon when the young men in town marched off to Cuba. This much we know. There were beer wagons and parlors heavy with musty brocades and collections of butterflies or shells. Queen Victoria set the fashion, and the British Navy kept the peace, at least if so minded. There were nickel mugs of beer, galluses, and ladies in wide-brimmed hats, and Sunday school picnics, and the world seemed immutable and as firmly fixed in its habits as the lamplighter, who in many towns still made his rounds at dusk, touching each lamp with importance and bringing on the night. It was the decade of the 90s, the gay 90s, they would call them later, and rightly so. The gay 90s. When it opened, there were 62,979,766 people living in the United States. That would grow in a decade to over 76 million. And it was a good decade to grow in. The old-type high bicycles were giving way to the so-called drop-frame model, and some sports even fitted them with pneumatic tires. Ladies were riding them more and more, despite dire warnings that this practice was harmful to future childbearing. In New York, there were at least 400 people who, most decidedly, did not ride bicycles. The 400, the cream of New York society, so named, they said, because only that number could fit comfortably into the ballroom of Mrs. William Astor's palatial, baroque, and sternly unattractive home. Young men of wealth made the grand tour of Europe, and less frequently, the tide was reversed. Rudyard Kipling, dark from the sun of India and out of favor with the royal family, took up residence in Vermont. Rudyard Kipling, still young but already a legend, his voice the corporate voice of Britain beyond the seas. He spoke briefly to America, and if you listened closely, you could hear the boots, 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 and the slaughter done on water, and the temple bells that say, "Come you back, you British soldier, come you back to Mandalay."
We know that when all the men who do things have done them, and after all the men who say things about those doings have said them, it is only words, nothing but words that live to show the present how men worked and thought in the past.
But no one was listening, really. There were so many sounds and so much new music to listen to. Music with a strange and exciting rhythm, born, they were saying, of the levees and the songs sung down in the bayous. By mid-decade, the future was growing impatient. William Allen White purchased the Gazette out in Emporia, Kansas, and started his career as a writer and editor. And young William Randolph Hearst, already owner of the San Francisco Examiner, bought the New York Journal and began to dream of an empire. And in Montreal, an unknown actress named Ethel Barrymore made her debut. There was gold in Alaska, new one-cylinder motor cars on some of the roads, and a firm, unshakable belief that all was well. You could tell it in the books they wrote, and the gentle, eminently moral plays they saw, and above all, in the music that they played. Played and sang until the dawn came, so subtly that they never knew that the days were numbered and another century was waiting.
I am the audience. And if I may say so, I'm a highly intellectual audience. I recognize the spiritual...
Listen to this voice. He would typify his time as surely as the others. Young he was then, and he would survive the decade. But it was his teacher, and he would never escape it. His name was George M. Cohan.
I recognize the spiritual hand of a great director, a master dramatist, who has so skillfully staged this tightly woven, disconnected spectacle of tragic nonsense. And so I am amused, and I laugh. And I applaud, and if I am any critic, this is a very good play. One of these days, I hope to meet the author,
and to compliment him for his marvelous entertainment.
It was 1896, Chicago. The Democrats meeting to find someone to beat McKinley to the White House. They didn't make it, but those who were there heard a young man come to the podium and talk about silver, the free coinage of silver. And all who heard would never forget. William Jennings Bryan. Three times he would run for the presidency, and three times he would lose. But he was young in 1896, and defeat was something still to be learned for him and for his generation. There was a shock of dark hair, a sort of unsophisticated flamboyance, and a voice that would not be silenced. Chicago, 1896, and the sound of history being made.
You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
The gay 90s, and gay they were, I suppose, give or take a depression or two, slums, and an almost musical comedy war in Cuba that reached a climax of a kind when one former Confederate general, a veteran of the Civil War, took a little too much refreshment and then charged the Spanish with the phrase, "Forward men, we got the darned Yankees on the run again." Gay and fun. At least those who remember those years say so. New Year's Eve, 1899, would be a special one. A new century was coming in, the 20th century. Motor cars would improve, and flying machines, and the fight against disease. But with every gain, there is a loss. Never to bicycle with your best girl again, or hear Edwin Booth read Richard. Bread would be baked and sold in stores, and the almost overwhelming odor that came when the kitchen oven was opened and the fresh loaves brought out would become lost and anachronistic. Wars wouldn't be gay and adventurous anymore. The business of disturbing the peace was soon to be in the hands of professionals. And somehow, summer nights would never seem so quiet nor so filled with stars. And so they met the new century. And it wasn't a minute old, I dare say, before the old-timers were talking of the good old days, the gay 90s, and speaking of the century past, even as some of us will talk of here and now, on the bright new morning of January 1, year of grace, 2000.